is a new battery test. 5, 4, 3. The basic principles of this new Vietnamese or current Vietnamese economic system, whatever one calls it, it is multi-component commodity economy, market mechanism economic system, multi-element economy, market economy, commodity economy, and several others. Whatever one calls this, there are several basic economic principles that appear to be in place and operative. And this is what one is told in asking officials in Hanoi and others, businessmen in Saigon, Ho Chi Minh City, what is your economic system, whatever you call it, what is it, what are its essences, what are its chief characteristics, its manifestations, its rules and general principles. There are several of these. First, they will say, there is the basic principle of letting the logic of the situation dictate economic policies and programs. Now this has both macro and micro meaning. That is, you do let the logic of the nationwide situation or condition dictate what economic policies and programs should be. But more specifically, or more commonly, it is microeconomic. That is, letting the logic of the specific situation, specific problem, dictate policies and plans. The best example for this is in the field of agriculture, chiefly because the Vietnamese economy is an agrarian economy. Some 85% of the labor force is engaged in food production, food distribution, so on. That is, feeding the other 100%. The rest of the economy, the other remaining 15%, is mostly service. There is no light industry. There is no heavy industry to speak of in Vietnam. Therefore, what happens on the farm is what is all important here. So, just as an example, say we have this State Farm or commune, and the objective is, the problem is how to grow more rice. And you apply then this rule of letting the logic of the situation dictate, which is to say that the locals involved, the farmers, the commune managers, the party people, everyone, among themselves decide what is the impediment to growing more rice. Is it a question of incentive or lack of incentive? Is it a shortage of proper seed and fertilizer, farm to market transportation? Is it a marketing question of marketing and distribution of profits? What is it? What is the problem that impedes growing more rice? And based on this analysis, you apply logic or common sense to devise a solution, letting the logic of the situation dictate. The second principle in this new present economic, reformed economic system, whatever you call it, is the legal right of all to gain profit through operation of private business. That phrase is in the Constitution now. The legal right of all to gain profit through operation of private business. That says quite a bit, particularly if you're talking about a Leninist system. But again, on the other hand, if you look at it a little more carefully, it doesn't say very much specific. I think the concept of this is one of personal free enterprise. The key term in this phrase, legal right of all to gain profit through operation of private business, it comes in the last two words, in the last two words, private business. Just what is the definition of private business? And I think within this, the key concept, the implied meaning is small. It should almost read, through the operation of small private business. Which means that you have the right to engage in personal enterprise. A man can open up a bicycle repair shop on the street corner. A woman can push a noodle cart through the streets. The family itself can engage in small, in family production, say, cottage industry type handicraft, that sort of thing. And it can be sort of an extended family, almost a whole clan. But it's got to be kept fairly small, and probably almost, if you're going to get away with it, everybody involved has to be blood related. What you cannot do is open a big factory. And this definition of operation of private business does not extend to opening a large factory, or factory where you hire 200 or 300 workers. You might be able to get away with doing that if it were part of a joint venture with a foreigner. But you don't have the right to do that. But it would be a privilege. It would be extended to you. It will not be a right, but you're guaranteed. Well, listening to these explanations, that is a foreigner, a capitalist system, is almost bound to say, well, this personal free enterprise and this letting the logic of the situation dictate policy sounds, when one suggests that this sounds suspiciously like the thinking of Adam Smith, the official to whom you're talking either agrees, Adam Smith, the father, the godfather of capitalism, the official neither agrees nor disagrees, saying it really doesn't matter what it sounds like. And indeed it really doesn't, so long as the concepts involved here are come to be held as being politically correct by the party, and particularly the party ideologues, the doctrinaire types, as it appears that it is. So it all becomes kind of an abstraction, what it is you call it. And I think the important thing, the important new development in this respect, is that this has now been made permanent, institutionalized, these concepts, in a way that they were not that way before. That is, in the run-up to the Seventh Party Congress and the subsequent National Assembly, All of these principles that I've set down were known and known to be operative, but the question was, were they here to stay? This is a temporary expedient, something that the hardliners go along with for the moment to get them out of the economic doldrums, but once that's accomplished, it'll be back to socialism as usual. That was the thinking earlier this year. And I think, though, there's a kind of psychological sea change by these two important meetings, National Assembly and the Seventh Congress. And so now it's reasonably safe to say that this process is irreversible, that there will never be any going back to the kind of socialism or economic, Stalinist type economic system which existed before. Never be too sure, but that seems to be a reasonably safe assumption, in my opinion. On the question of foreign economic aid, trade, U.S. embargo, etc., for some years, since 86, have had a policy of, on paper, of soliciting foreign economic aid. But until fairly recently, this was never accompanied by any effort to translate this principle, this objective, into reality. That is, the leadership was never willing or able to make sacrifices in other sectors in the name of serving their goals and objectives in achieving higher levels of foreign economic aid and trade. Then, a couple of years ago, this changed in that there became a true determination not to allow these other problems, such as Cambodia, to impede the solicitation. What happened then, however, was the so-called revolution of 1989, which scared the bejeepers out of the leadership in the fear that soliciting this foreign economic aid, however badly needed it was, however desirable it was, could inadvertently bring in inadvertent change that would be totally negative from their viewpoint. This was the reading they took of what happened in East Europe, a system that wasn't working very well. Changes were made, tended to open it up to the outside world. Closer relations with the capitalist world, especially in Europe, East, West Europe. And what happened, the whole thing inadvertently set in motion a kind of self-destruct mechanism. So the problem now is how to achieve this foreign economic aid and trade without in any way destabilizing or introducing factors that will destabilize the internal situation. Not destabilize them deliberately, but inadvertently. Hong Kong, March 21st. One of the most difficult evaluations to make of the Vietnamese economy has to do with the effects of geographic regionalism on what is now being done and will be done in the future, the economic sector. Background graph on geographic regionalism, three-way split, two-way split. Oh. Vietnam today continues to have a dual economy, north-south. It's in some ways more pronounced 15 years after the war than it was at any time in the past 15 years. This is characterized by a kind of beginning of an economic takeoff in South Vietnam, potential for which was always there, but sort of kept down, suppressed, under control by the Northerners, and who have now, for various reasons, relaxed that control, stopped trying to hold back the South. More to the point, however, has to do with the way the Southerners approach the economy, the way Southerners do business, and the way Southerners relate their burgeoning economic system to official Hanoi. Seems to be a kind of general agreement in the South among Southern businessmen, even party cadres or state officials in the economic sector, and party cadres are concerned with economic matters, kind of agreement among them that they will ignore rather than try to change the regulations and the ways of doing things as handed down by Hanoi. This is perhaps good and bad. If you have a bad economic problem, situation, it's a result of the center and central direction and central mismanagement. There are two ways you can do this. You can hit it head on, tackle it, confront it, try to change it, or you can simply try to evade it, get around it. Both systems can work. But I would think that the first actually is the preferable. Got a bad situation, so change it. See that it's changed. Force the change. If you try to simply evade it, you leave it in place, and it continues to cause problems. It has other effects. Maybe you can fix things so it works for you and your enterprise, but it still is hurting other enterprises with whom you have some relationships and mutual interests, mutual purposes. But the Southerners are very good at this. They have always been very good at it. All Vietnamese are very good at it. And therefore the conclusion one comes to on this is that the economy in Vietnam will probably continue to improve and develop, particularly in the South, and it will do it despite the reforms, despite whether reforms are made or not made in Hanoi. If true reforms are implemented, it will help this whole process along, and things will generally move much better and faster. If not the right mechanism, right policies are not adopted in Hanoi, it will still continue to move along fairly well. The only thing that could set it back would be a determination by Hanoi to prevent this from moving ahead, improving. In other words, to force the Southerners to stop ignoring or circumventing the regulations and really enforce them. That would definitely be a step back. It's very hard to see that that is likely or even probable, even possible in the foreseeable future. The whole trend is away from it. It's because of the discredited character of central planning, and to a very large degree the discredited character and qualities of the party cadres, the once bright shining examples now badly tarnished. They do not command the authority, the moral authority that they once did have. make the point somewhere that in terms of consumer goods, there is an abundance of it, particularly in the South. This is both a plus and minus. It takes the pressure off public discontent about the unavailability of basic commodities and needs. Or at least it shifts this discontent from grumbling over unavailability of consumer goods to the ever-rising cost of these same goods, chiefly due to inflation. On the other hand, this permissiveness, which has reduced, caused this tremendous influx of consumer goods. All types from all areas, all levels of, use the French suitcase example, is economically detrimental. Is what Vietnam does not need now is French suitcases or cognac or television sets. Needs is capital investment. Add to that text of two, a four-party joint communique, two-party joint communique. Quote, 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 new Viet Accord signed, Paris, AP, June 13, 73. Viet truce violations lowest in 5 months, Washington Post, June 22, 73. General elections in South Vietnam, unquote, Vietnam Courier, Hanoi, July, 73. Cambodian government proposes ceasefire. AP, July 7, 73. Interview by BBC of GVN Foreign Minister Vuong, V-U-O-N-G, V-A-N, Bach, B-A-C. Skip that. Position of the GVN on recognition of the quote so-called subquote PRG, July 25th, 1973. On the quote, on the implementation of the Paris Agreement, 90 days after the Paris Agreement communique, GVN Foreign Ministry, April 28th, 73. Quote, restructuring the empire, Nixon Doctrine After Vietnam, Bulletin of, by Michael Clare, K-L-A-R-E, Bulletin Concerned Scholars, August 73. quote, Vietnam rivals unreconciled. UNRECONCILED, Henry Bradshaw, Washington Star, August 1, 1973. Quote, Hanoi builds roads in South, unquote, Washington Post, August 28, 1973. War is peace in South Vietnam, unquote, by Thuan That Tien, former South Vietnam journalist. Orientations, August 73. Sole genuine representative of South Vietnamese people, unquote, South Vietnam in struggle, September 5, 1970. Quote, North Vietnam airfields in South draw U.S. Saigon protests, Washington Post, September 12, 1973. And that's it for September. Quote, Harriman on Vietnam, colon, Q called barrier to the peace people want, unquote, Christian Science Monitor, December 31, 1970. General U Thant, New York, October 28, 1969. And these are out of sync here. Areas of National Reconstruction by John Arias, first word, by John Balaban, Social Progress, Presbyterian Church, USA, December 69. Statement at 46th session of the Paris Conference by PRG delegate Madam Nguyen T. Binh, B-I-N-H. Hanoi aide, quote, Hanoi aide boycotts Paris talks, Washington Post, December 12, 1969. Thant asks wider Viet government, Washington Post, December 23, 1969. Hodge takes leave of Paris, Washington Post, December 5, 1969. That's it for 69.